Welcome to Muffliato, a Harry Potter podcast where we fill your ears to prevent you from hearing nearby conversations. I'm Josh.
And I'm Blake, and today we come face to face with our worst fears as we continue our journey through Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban and come now to the seventh chapter, The Boggart in the Wardrobe. Now, Josh, last chapter we saw Harry go to two of his classes, new, you know, first lessons for the year. That would be magical creatures with Hagrid and Hagrid's first lesson, and also Professor Trelawney and divination. And now we get two more subjects. This chapter, it's kind of like split quite nicely. But these subjects are polar opposites of each other. It's like Harry's favorite class and Harry's least favorite class by a mile.
Yeah, definitely. And I think what's interesting is that while Harry will always kind of put up with care of magical creatures because of Hagrid, Defense Against the Dark Arts is a subject where, for this year at least, he both loves the teacher and the class, which is pretty fun.
And is really good at it,
of course. Yeah. And Blake, I think this is really interesting in the books, where in the first few chapters of the time at Hogwarts, we really get the most school life, or maybe I should say timetable life, that we'll often get for the rest of the year. You know, from this point forward, a lot of the time in Lupin's class will be quickly described in a sentence, and we're given more insight into those private meetings they have, you know? And so these first few chapters are pretty cool, where we get almost like a whole class insight into what's going on. And I just really like them. I think, you know, the books would be far too long if they did this more often, or if Rowling did this more often, but it is pretty cool to have a bit of an insight into what they're actually doing day-to-day life.
Yeah. It's quite interesting because, you know, day-to-day life doesn't really sustain a whole novel, but it is intriguing for already the super fan, right? Like, because you're like, oh, that's what people crave. They're like, give me a 50-hour whole, you know, Harry Potter series movie, all that. And it's just sort of simple. And you're like, yeah, but no, you know, and it's like.
Well, and Blake, as both of us are teachers, you know, it's interesting to see, you know, it's fascinating. I'm sure if you're someone else out there who is involved in the medical field, you're probably thinking, give me more of Madame Pomfrey.
Yeah, that's so true, actually, being like, I want to know all these cures. I want to know, like, you know, that would probably very much interest you. Whereas we're kind of like, oh, let's go to this teacher. Or we haven't actually, you know, we hear about, you know, a couple of other teachers that we don't even see their classes, right? Or we hear about a lot of Hermione's, you know, the study of runes and all these other classes or whatever, where you know, we don't experience that, you know, because that's not what Harry is doing. That's not Harry's focus. So, you know, because we're sort of in this story, we're sort of stuck with Harry and what he's doing. And so, yeah, I think that would be pretty interesting if we could look into the other teachers and see their classes.
Yeah, definitely. If J.R.R. Tolkien wrote the Harry Potter series, we would have plenty of time in ancient runes.
Yeah, that's so true, eh? And there'd be a whole other book devoted for it. You know, I'm not a big Lord of the Rings fan, but
for ancient runes,
isn't it like is it the Silmarillion or something? So what is it, Josh?
Silmarillion.
Silmarillion. That like goes into crazy detail or something about, you know, more of this world. It's kind of like, I think that's what the Potter fans are wanting from JK, this like just all encompassing, you know, thing. But, you know, we don't get that. We do just get this sort of a brief view, but it is quite nice to have a look in, especially Lupin's class, who's, you know, kind of here for the first time.
She leaves us wanting more, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. We want to attend the next class and the class after that, but that's not how this works. You know, the story must go on. So, but much like the story, how about we get on and we'll give that chapter summary and we'll get into it.
Love it. Well, it's double potions with Snape, and this is made even more unbearable by Draco's return from the hospital wing. Not only does Snape instruct Harry and Ron to prepare Malfoy's potion ingredients, but Draco also promises that Hagrid will soon lose his job thanks to his father's connections at the Ministry. Somewhat surprisingly, and out of nowhere, Malfoy asks Harry if he plans to seek revenge on Sirius Black. Harry, confused, dismisses the comments. Meanwhile, Neville is struggling as usual in the potions dungeon. Hermione tries to help him, but the net result is 5 points lost for Gryffindor in exchange for a healthy Trevor the Toad. Leaving the dungeon, Harry and Ron again notice that Hermione has disappeared and then reappeared in Professor Lupin's room. But before they can question her thoroughly, the class begins. Lupin informs the class that the lesson will be a practical one. They travel as a group to the staff room. Inside, they find Professor Snape, who quickly leaves the room, but not before insulting Neville in front of the class. In response, Lupin assures Snape that Neville will play a starring role in this class. With Snape gone, the students learn that there is a boggart, a shapeshifter, in the wardrobe. Lupin explains that a boggart takes the form of whatever a person fears most. Together, they will work to repel it using the ridiculous charm. Neville is called on first and asked his greatest fear. The class laugh together when he reveals that he fears Snape most of all. Lupin considers this and seeks to make some wardrobe modifications to Neville's mental image of Snape. When the wardrobe is opened, Snape appears, but using the charm, the professor suddenly has on Neville's grandmother's clothes. Each student successfully repels the boggart, but before Harry has a turn, Lupin steps in front of him and causes it to vanish. Harry ponders why he did not get to face the creature, as well as what form it would have taken. Ron and Harry also discuss what Hermione's fear would have been, as she, along with Harry, were the only two who did not get a turn to face the creature.
I love that in this chapter, we both see Snape being, a total, loser to Neville, but then Neville kind of getting one up on Snape as well. And, there's definitely after this chapter, Snape's not too kind to Neville, especially after he hears about this incident.
Yeah.
But
Hogwarts is the place where secrets go to die.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Because the news spreading around about what Neville did to Snape happens very quickly in the next chapter.
Yeah, that would be so embarrassing as a tip, but you kind of bring it on yourself with such a mean reputation. And it almost goes to say, I don't know if we've ever discussed it, but like, it's just so horrible the way Snape actually, sort of treats Neville. And, it's the idea of, obviously, Neville is just hopeless at potions and Snape is very good. And that's maybe one part of it where, Snape is just frustrated at Neville's inability, to do it. I don't think he's quite like Harry, where if you remove, Snape from the situation, Harry does a decent job at potions, where it's like, it's not great, but it's not too bad, but there's that other, and I'm sure you would have heard of this, there's that other side of things that when Snape looks at Neville, he looks at kind of this other boy who could have fulfilled the prophecy that, because Voldemort didn't go after Neville, Lily died. And so that's kind of that, I feel like, would be that main undertone of how mean he is to Neville is because of that.
Yeah, that's a great point, Blake. And I think something that probably we don't think about too often is if we look at kind of that explanation given to us by Dumbledore in the Order of the Phoenix and what could have been and the prophecy and all those things, if we kind of read back into the books, people's interactions with Harry and with Neville, it's really telling. And I probably hadn't thought about that as much as I should have. And you made that really clear. And just for Snape, not to excuse it, but that I think is certainly part of it. You can't deny that. That's great. But I think another thing, Blake, that we think of is Snape is without a doubt an expert in his field, potion maker. But I think one of my least favorite parts about him as a teacher is not even like the bullying is obviously bad. But what I think is less obviously bad, but equally true, is just how serious Snape takes himself. like you look at someone like Dumbledore and Dumbledore is taken seriously by every single person in the wizarding world, except for himself. He is able to laugh and poke jokes at himself. And I think that's really, that's just important for life, not to take yourself so seriously. And Snape takes himself far too seriously. There's no way that, even if he hates Neville, again, not saying that's a good thing, but surely a different professor could kind of chuckle that it's kind of funny that this kid fears me that much that I'm his boggart. Like,
yes.
I don't know. It just seems like you go through life a really tragic figure if you're not able to laugh at yourself.
I know, exactly. And I think it's healthy almost to have a little chuckle at yourself and be like, you don't take yourself so seriously. That's actually a good thing. Otherwise,
imagine if a Snape was a, like, if it was all an act, like in the staff lounge room, he was the life of the party. McGonagall and Flitwick were like on the floor with him laughing jokes. And then he takes on this sullen face just when he leaves the door. But anyway, very different character if that's the case, but.
Yes, that would not be Snape. It's like, as in this chapter, you know, Lupin comes into the staff room to bring his class in to face the boggart or whatever, and Snape's there, and he's like, "I'll leave," but like, imagine if Snape's all of a sudden cracking up at a joke and something, and then looks and it's like, "Oh, resume the Snape kind of mode."
Yeah, that's right.
That would be pretty funny. Snape is not actually Snape. That would be very, very weird. But I mean, you touched on it as we come into our key theme of fear.
Yeah,
we see that very much with obviously Snape treating Neville this way, and Neville, you know, just must be in a state of fear when he is in that class. And then naturally, you know, we get a boggart, which is a creature based around fears. If a Dementor is based around kind of sort of depression as an idea, then clearly boggarts are a creature based around fear.
Yeah, and it's interesting because unlike the Dementors, I guess there's kind of two differences there. I like the connection you made to kind of fear and depression, but with, you know, with the Dementors, they're at once so much more, I guess, actually threatened, right? A boggart is more like a pest. You know, we see that most clearly in Order of the Phoenix, where Molly can't repel a boggart. That's, I think, the first time we see a boggart unable to be repelled, and she's just lying on the ground in tears, right?
Yes.
So it's not actually threatening to you. But at the same time, for the average witch or wizard, it would be far more likely to face a boggart than it would be to face a Dementor. And so, you know, it would be something that is probably fairly likely to come about in your daily goings on, especially if you inhabit any kind of like antique shops or seems like old houses. And so, you know, while it's maybe not as threatening as the real thing like the Dementor, this is something that you'd run across. And the idea of actually seeing a terrible, terrible fear would be brutal. And I think quite difficult to, in that moment, switch flick the switch and be all of a sudden able to know what you need to do is not fight that image, but fight the boggart.
Yeah, I feel like a creature based around fear, and that was really actually interesting, you know, being a domestic thing, like you said, being something that more wizards would come into contact with, and how, like, just the idea of it being something that you'd come across and maybe not realize that it is a boggart, like, depending on what you're afraid of, you know, would you realize that it's a boggart? Would you, you know, and know how to kind of combat it with that sort of the ridiculous kind of spell there? Like, how would you know? And then obviously, you know, clearly it's trying times for Molly Weasley when she goes up against it, and it's just, you know, it just ends up being dead bodies of her family and everybody. And it's just like, that sounds horrible. Like, you know, it clearly, like, it could range something silly, like maybe being a spider or something like that, like smaller spider or whatever, to something being like a ghost or, I don't know, just something like that. But then to see dead body, that's a quite a lot.
Well, and I think too, what it shows is the development of someone in their life that, you know, when you're, what would third year students be? I think they'd be 13 years old. When you're 13 years old, your fears are very physical. You know, people fear banshees and they fear snakes and spiders.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you're a mother like Molly, your fears are more abstract, as well as being a more personal, more connected to other people. And she fears the death of her family. You know, and I think too, it's probably not a perfect one to one, but even as you mentioned, you know, Dementors being this kind of stand-in for depression, Molly's Dementors, not so much, you know, Ron's and spiders, but Molly's fear of boggarts, or fear represented by boggarts, ties in with the idea of anxiety as well. And again, it's not nearly as perfect, but both of these things really do show just how much kind of fear and sadness play a role in this book.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, fear is something that comes out quite strongly in this chapter because it has a physical representation through the boggart, as well as just, you know, it's naturally present whenever Neville looks at Snape. And so we do get some pretty fun things on seeing people's fears, like seeing some of these students' fears. And no, we don't see Harry's or we don't see Hermione's, which is a bit of a shame. But obviously we know kind of by later on in the book why Harry, you know, Lupin stopped Harry, because all of a sudden Lupin's thinking that Voldemort's going to pop out. You know, I'm not too sure, you know, I love them guessing at Hermione's fear. I don't know if you took a stab in the dark, and maybe this leads kind of almost into character development. If you took a stab at the dark to be like, what would Hermione be afraid of? What would the Boggart sort of represent? What do you think?
Well, we do know what it represents at the end of the book.
Oh, that's like in the final exam.
Yeah, it's McGonagall being all disappointed at her, right?
So it's almost like that, like appreciation. Or...
Well, yeah, I think it's, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's connected to her failing in homework as well. Like she fails all of her exams and McGonagall is scolding her or something
yeah.
like that.
Which is like, okay, that's what you fear. She's almost got a very sort of focused view on school and everything revolves around that, which is quite funny.
I think later on, even before the series is over, it very quickly would have shifted to her parents, who are really not natives to the wizarding world, being hurt and attacked. I think that would be.
Yeah, definitely. The other character that we like, I think gets very developed sort of in this chapter or more so than any other is Remus Lupin, right? Like it's his first lesson and Harry has his first class with Professor Lupin and everybody loves it. You know, everybody thinks that, wow, this is like now my favorite class. You know, this is, you know, and as we know, he is the best defense against the dark arts teacher.
Yeah, he is by far the best overall defense against the dark arts teacher. And really probably maybe with one exception of private tutor with Dumbledore, Harry's true. Favorite teacher
in
the whole series, without a doubt. And like the other thing we do see here, and we'll mention it more later, we also get a brief, and I think as the reader, we're almost left wondering, do we have the whole picture of Lupin's Boggart? Like it turns into something crystal ball like it's described, but it's almost like we're wondering, was that the whole thing? Surely not. Maybe it was starting to take form. And so we're left with this little kind of juicy piece of foreshadowing, which we'll touch on later, but we also do see that key development here as well.
Yeah, definitely.
As well, like we also see a little bit of Lupin's personality, not just as a teacher, but we see maybe something of what he would have been like as a student in how he deals with Peeves, with the Waddy Wuzzy. And I think that, you know, just shows that, you know, as a student, he did. And I think we don't know about the Marauders just yet, but we get an insight into how Lupin would have been as a student, a little more carefree than he certainly seems now.
Yeah, he seems with Peeves anyway, how he's not annoyed by Peeves. And hey, maybe that's because he hasn't been teaching there long enough. But, you know, he was a student there and obviously maybe had interactions with Peeves before, because Peeves clearly, you know, has a nickname for, you know, Loony Lupin. I feel like it's almost like he gets Peeves, he gets his kind of, you know, cheeky rule break, you know, because maybe it reminds him in similar ways of his old friends, you know, back when they were in school and you know, Lupin was kind of the more maybe mature one and you know, James and Sirius were kind of the cheeky kind of rule breakers. Maybe they sort of remind him of that. He very calmly kind of says, like, Peeves, you know, like, we shouldn't do that. You should, you know, take it out. You know, Filch wouldn't like it, kind of thing, rather than getting just sort of all up in arms and angry with Peeves.
Yeah, I think as you look at, I think McGonagall and Flitwick deal with Peeves, they're definitely more frustrated, and they're easier, I think, to get under their skin. Which, you know, speaking as a sibling, and if you've ever, you know, purposely try to get under your sibling's skin, you can really resonate with Peeves spotting the teachers who get most annoyed and targeting them.
Yeah, that's so true.
And like the other thing, we've mentioned both of these things already, as far as the Boggart being part of our world building. It is a shapeshifter, as it's mentioned in the chapter, which does bring to mind, you know, almost if this is some kind of like not scientific, but magical categorization of creatures. You know, are there this whole group of creatures which are shapeshifters, of which the Boggart is a part? I have wondered that.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be kind of interesting to see if there's a sort of a range of creatures, or even just like whether they're part of the same family or just creatures with that ability. You know, there's surely got to be other creatures that have that kind of shape-shifting ability. It seems pretty extensive for a boggart, though. Like, it can change into a creature or a person. I don't think it can change into much more than that because it's still one creature. I don't know if it can, like, if it can change into a scene. You know, it's more
it gets I guess closest to that with Molly Weasley, where there's multiple bodies on the ground.
Is it multiple bodies, or is it one body at a time? That keeps changing?
I think it does keep changing.
I just don't know. You know, it's almost like it can only, you know, represent one thing. Otherwise, you know, maybe it's confusing itself. But I mean, it's definitely not a creature that you'd want to face against, you know, like definitely, you know, you'd have a sense of fear. And you know, I mean, we asked the question of Hermione and wondered that, but what would the boggart be for you, Josh, if you had to face against your worst fear? What would that come up to be?
So if I'll maybe go two different directions, if it was something physical, I really don't like snakes, and I definitely think it would have been something like that. I don't know exactly what form it would have taken, maybe a giant kind of viper-like snake.
Yep, okay.
Kind of similar. I can't remember who it is in the movie, but someone has a snake come out.
We'll talk
about the movie scene in a second, but that would be a physical one. But I do think, you know, Molly's fear, while it's not something that I personally am fearful of regularly, Molly's fear of family dying is pretty haunting, especially as a new father. So that would be pretty real as well. And what about you, Blake?
And touching on the Molly thing, you know, she, you know, it's almost like a time of war, and so that's where her fears and her thoughts.
It's far more realistic.
It is far more realistic for her and stuff. And because obviously, being a father, definitely agree that's kind of that is one of those things that you would fear most, right? But like creature wise. You know, I was wondering, if it was a creature, what would it be? And if it was like a person scolding me like Professor McGonagall, like what would that look like, you know? But I don't know, creature wise, it's very interesting because you think of like, there are a lot of scary creatures out there, but like which ones do I fear? You know, which ones, if I came across, would I be like, oh, no, thank you. You know, like a giant cockroach or something. That would that would be not the nicest. So, I'm not too sure. Surely something like the death of a loved one would have to be that biggest fear, you know, like it is hard to think of, you know, some kind of big creature, you know, because any creature could probably be a bit scary depending on your situation. If you're in a cage alone with a lion, I wouldn't be so, you know, hot for that. Yeah. But so anyway, maybe that deserves a bit more thought and maybe a bit more look into at some point. It's definitely hard to think off the top. But maybe it comes more to mind to our listeners. You know, maybe they have more a fear that is quite sort of on the surface, where it's like, yep, that's straight away my fear. That's exactly what my boggart would be. And it would be kind of interesting. So maybe that might need to
let us know.
Need to be an Instagram question. I might post that this week or something and just be like, what would it be for our listeners? So,
Alongside the boggart, we also get our first view of the ridiculous spell.
Yes.
And that spell, of course, is used to repel the boggart. And Lupin is the one who eventually finishes it off. So there's kind of a progression that, you know, makes the boggart weaker and weaker and then finished eventually. And the other spell we get an insight into, we have mentioned, is the Wuddy Wuzzy, which is the spell that it seems very specific.
It doesn't even fit the rest of almost like the other spell names. It's just who invented it, you know, like Wuddy Wuzzy. Like, I can understand the wad part of it, right? Because it's this is a projectile jinx, that, you know, can be used to propel a small, as it's described, a small wad of material at high velocity. So it's like Wuddy Wuzzy, but what's the Wuzzy part? You know, like sure, it's like it's like Expelliarmus, you know, like Waterless, or I don't know, something that has a bit more Waterless, magic, yeah, pizzazz or kind something.
Kind of Latinous.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, exactly. So it is kind of funny. You think it's almost like going back to that first book of Philosopher's Stone, like the spell that Ron's brothers give to Ron, yes, you know, yes, about turn this stupid fat rat yellow or something. And it's like, mm-hmm, it's not even a magical sounding spell, but.
Yeah, definitely. Like the other thing I wanted to ask about, this is kind of related to world building, is this is one of, I think, the most famous non-battle scenes in all the movies. You know, the scene of this represented in the movie version of Prisoner of Azkaban is pretty well known. And I just wanted to know, you know, are you a fan of this scene? Do you appreciate the representation? Is it too much where you can hardly even picture the book without thinking of the movie? How do you find that?
Yeah, I mean, so I think the first kind of scene in this chapter with Snape and Neville, I think that's, you know, I think it is great. Like, I think that's very, you know, makes sense. It, when it comes to the actual, like, Lupin part, I think it does a really good job at getting across people's fears. You know, when you, I mean, one of the things that I always notice is that, like, swinging creepy clown. And because I think yeah, that's the creature that, like, it kind of, before it turns into a Dementor, which it actually does, you know, they take that liberty and show, yeah, kind of it, yes, turning into a Dementor for Harry. You know, it's that sort of clown that's in a Jack in the Box, kind of going back and forth, yes, back and forth. Yeah. And then it's kind of Harry's looking at that, and that kind of turns it into this thing. And I think that was necessary in the way that when Lupin talks to Harry, he says it's a very wise thing, because it's fear itself that you fear. It's not Lord Voldemort. It's fear. Mm. It's, you know, self. And that's what Harry's, you know, fearing is, you know, he's fearing fear. And at that stage, currently, the thing that most threatens him, the thing that most is he's most confused about, is why he fainted at this Dementor, why he was so affected, and the hearing of, you know, his mother's scream, whether he's processing that and working out what that actually is. You know, he's taking all of that in when he comes across a Dementor, not just the physical fright of something, but just the emotional and physical toll that it has on his body. So I do like that they take that liberty myself, like that they say, hey, here's a Dementor that appears, and then, you know, Lupin does that, kind of stands in front. I just think the scene is very, yeah, visual. Yeah. I really do like it.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, Blake, that is really cool about that scene is we really get a sense for what it must be like and what it is like to face your fears with others. And yeah, there's this real sense that, you know, because the music is playing and because there's this jostling of all the students, that though the student in the front is facing his or her greatest fear, they're kind of supported by everyone around them. And it's really quite a nice thing that's there. All right, for foreshadowing, Blake, one idea I had was, as we talk about foreshadowing in this book, let's have a little bit of a Lupin tracker, where we kind of ask ourselves, what do we know so far? Do we know what, you know, at what point would we say that people other than Hermione really should have figured this out? And this is our first clue in this chapter. And what is that first clue?
Yeah, that would be kind of what the Boggart takes shape when it comes to Lupin standing in the way and actually being the one that the Boggart's facing. And you mentioned it before, it's that crystal-like orb, you know, orb, yeah, thing. And it's like, you know, it is mentioned later on, it's like, I wonder why, you know, Lupin's afraid of a shiny orb or whatever, like crystal balls, and maybe because, you know, they go that direction, it's easier to think, yeah, is he afraid of divination or something like that, because, you know, they're taking divination classes. But, you know, we later know that it's going to be a full moon, you know, that's kind of his greatest fear.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think in the movie, it looks a lot more like a moon.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. That's maybe one of the, in a movie, they're almost kind of giving it to you on a silver platter.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, in the book, they can have a bit more foreshadowing. They can have a bit more tease, and maybe, you know, that's just the plus of a book. Right. So, yeah. So it's okay.
Yeah, I think the other things we know so far, Blake, are that he is regularly shabby, looks quite sickly from time to time. That's kind of on our werewolf tracker foreshadowing. The other thing, and we haven't talked about this really yet, is Lupin's name. Lupin's name ought to be a big clue to us.
Yeah, Remus, as far because as what's that's, gonna that's Greek, isn't it? Or is it it's
Roman?
It's Roman mythology. That's
so,
right.
Yeah. So the twins, Romulus and Remus, were connected with the founding of Rome. They were the twins who were raised by wolves, and not only that, but Romulus actually kills Remus, and then the city is named Rome after Romulus, and so. For Remus, perhaps a slight foreshadowing of his upcoming death as well.
Yeah.
But also his last name, Lupin, Lupin for wolf. And so he's literally named Remus, the child raised by wolves, wolf. And so really we're getting strong senses that this is going to be where this is all going.
Yeah. And I love that about Rowling's writing is that she brings in little hints about names. Like if you were to look at all the names in the book and then maybe like look at their sort of Roman mythology, Greek mythology, whatever that might be, kind of Latin based, you know, terms, it's kind of like, I feel like you'd get a hint for this story already. But you know, people don't do that. People just read stories. So that's a good thing. But then it's after the fact you come back and when you're doing a bit more sort of in-depth research, there's depth there to those names and those characters. And I just love that she thought about these characters so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Blake, the significance of this chapter is really found in the relationships that are being built with Professor Lupin. And then as far as the whole Sirius Black plotline, we also see that Malfoy clearly knows something about Sirius and Harry that he isn't willing to tell.
Yeah, he's kind of teasing. He's waiting. He's baiting Harry into that conversation to be like, yeah, Malfoy, that's right. I'm going to go get him. And then Malfoy's like, sucker, I got you, you know,
and it's
kind of like teasing him over this knowledge. And then they later realize that Malfoy must know something when they figure it out kind of thing.
Yes.
So, you know, definitely fun. Like this is a really good chapter, I think, because you know, whilst you get a bit of that hatred for Malfoy and Snape, you know, in that first scene, it does finish strongly with like a really great class that makes you, it kind of just draws you kind of back in, like some of those potions class, you're like, yeah, I don't really want to be in that class even as a muggle, but you know, the Defense Against the Dark Arts class with Lupin, like those are the classrooms you want. You know, I love at the start of the lesson it's like, you know, you won't need your books, you know, put the books away, today's will be a practical lesson. And it's like that's what every kid wants to hear when they're at school, is like, you know, the science class, we're going to be doing an experiment or something like that. Or today we're putting our books away and we're going for a walk outside to do this thing. It's like, yes, something like, you know, awesome's about to happen. So I do love that, you know, this is sort of the introduction of Remus Lupin in his classroom. Yes. Being, you know, the teacher that everybody loves or at least the Gryffindors love. And I think that's pretty exciting that we now have kind of a better view of four in this chapter and the previous chapter, four of Harry's classes and his first lessons in those classes.
Cool.
And another thing, just before we close out the episode, Josh, and something that Josh and I want to share with you guys, the listeners, is that we actually now have a website that you can visit. So along with sending us an, you know, email, which we normally love to receive questions via email, we do have a website as well that you can get in touch with us via that, as well as go check that out. You know, little information about Josh and I there. You can listen to the episodes there as well. But that's muffliatopodcast.com. Pretty simple. So go have a look at that, check it out, and you know, let us know what you think. But anyway, thank you for listening. Head over to iTunes and leave a review. Your support helps keep the magic alive. Get in touch and ask us a question via Instagram. Send us an email at muffliatopodcast@gmail.com or on our new website. And to continue the adventure, join us next time as we discuss the 8th chapter of Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, Flight of the Fat Lady.